and welcome back to the Palace Way podcast. The drinks are out, an excellent result worth celebrating at Old Trafford, and a window to cover as well, all in this episode of the podcast. How are we all doing today, gents?
Yeah, I'm very well, thank you. I think Pat mentioned in our pre-chat that he might be going on the whiskey a bit later today. No alcohol for me, however, though. Tea getting me through tonight after a long day of waiting for Palace to announce Ben Chilwell yesterday.
There's a saying, it's 5 o'clock somewhere, and fortunately for me, being on the east coast of the United States, it's somewhere is right here. So yeah, to join you guys a little bit soon here, but glad to be back on, especially after a nice, exciting, monumental win away from home.
I mean, our away form this season has just been absolutely fantastic, and that's something we'll get into later in the episode as well. But the first thing I want to start with is the topic I think everyone will want to hear about, especially with Bobby Manzi on and myself. So yeah, the transfer window. The two signings, Romain Eze and Ben Chilwell. Just off the bat, before we get into the discussion, how would you rate it out of 10, Bobby?
It's a really difficult one to rate out of 10, to be honest. Normally, I find these things a lot simpler. Now, I'm going to judge my number on essentially what Glasner asked for at the start of the window, which was an attacker who can be an impact substitution and a left wing back. And I will say the club did that pretty well. The issue was obviously that they lost three players and weren't able to replace those. Maybe you can say they've replaced Sheikh Doucouré with Adam Wharton coming back from injury, so you've still got the same amount of numbers in midfield.
Like a new signing, I'm told.
Yeah, something like that. So they've still got the same amount of numbers if you're playing a numbers game in midfield. But obviously they're two centre-backs down, and that is a concern. Maybe Ben Chilwell could cover at left centre-back if things got really bad. Jefferson Lerma could also potentially play there. Maybe Tyrick Mitchell, but I think that would be a real stretch. He would go into that position. So my slightly elongated way of going all around the house is to give you a number is going to be a 6 out of 10.
Yeah, not great material here to follow up with the same number, but that's exactly where I leaned on too, for similar reasons too. On its face, if we looked at this on January 1st, and this is how it happened, I would say, 7 or 8 out of 10, because we did exactly what Glasner wanted us to do, and we filled in the gaps that he wanted us to fill in. But as you said, losing Chalobah back to Chelsea and having those two long-term season-ending injuries kind of changed the demand for us, and we didn't see that change in our market strategy. So really nervous about the back line. I was just talking about this to our little group chat with my Tampa Palace folks, which shout out to the boys there. And, we're growing steadily. But you look at our back three, we don't have a single true center back to come on in rotation as a substitute. Our backup choices are really Jefferson Lerma, who is a central midfielder and also is needed in central midfield right now because we don't have much depth there. Nathaniel Klein, who is a fullback by trade, and Joel Ward, I suppose, who is injured, I believe, and also not a true central defender. So just a little bit concerning there, and that's why I would put 6 out of 10. On its face, I don't mind the two incomings, but 6 out of 10 because of that.
Yeah, I think that's probably where I'd lean it as well. I mean, I think I'd say 7.5 out of 10 is what I imagine doing what the club wants probably would be. So I would say that had we not lost Chalobah and then the injuries to Doucouré and Riyad. We've loaned out Agbonone, which was a good call. We've loaned out Schlupp, we've loaned out Holding. I'm happy to see those players move on in some capacity, and that will lean towards a permanent exit for both in the summer, you'd think. But we've weakened our squad from when we came into it, and for that reason I feel sort of guilty addressing the window positively. And I think the club should too, in a little way, because while I love the signing of Romain Eze, obviously had an instant impact, didn't come on at Old Trafford, Ben Chilwell I actually think brings such a good quality. We've missed a sort of technically proficient left wing back since Patrick Van Aanholt's second season at the club, and I think it could be very, very exciting if he can stay fit, and that is a very, very big if, and my main concern. For 6 months or so, maybe even less, a player with his injury record needs to stay fit to make that loan signing pretty much worth it. Although I think we've gotten a pretty sweet deal overall in terms of finances, and that will probably be related to the risk as well. So I don't know, all that taken into account, I really wish we'd signed at least another player. A centre back would have been especially well thought out, given we know Mark's leaving in the summer pretty much, and will want to sell him with a year left on his deal. Similarly, there were talks of a centre mid signing, that Diouf fellow out of Lens was one of them, but don't know if I would have necessarily wanted that even with the injury, just because of the significance of Wharton coming back. So I guess it's just missing out on a centre back that puts me off. So I'll go a little bit lower and say 5.5, just because I think we could have done a bit better.
Yeah, no, I think you make some really good points, Bruno. I think on a centre back, it was ultimately quite a difficult deal to do. There was a move for Pavlovic that they were interested in doing, but the price was just too high. He's obviously played for AC Milan. He played in the Milan derby at the weekend. In January is a difficult market in any time of the in any season, especially in the light of the whole PSR January that we have now, where clubs are really reluctant to buy, which means obviously it's hard, it's difficult for you to buy if other clubs aren't willing to buy players in the market and get the market moving. But yeah, so Pavlovic was one they looked at. There wasn't really anyone else of real note that they made a move for. It's You have to look at it in the sense that Palace are ultimately looking for their Gueye replacement in the summer. That's what they would have advanced now. And the players that they see filling that void weren't available in January. So they're not just going to buy a stopgap for £20 million just for this season while Chalobah isn't there and obviously Riyad is injured just to get through the rest of the campaign. It just doesn't make any sense business-wise.
You can certainly see that side of it for sure, why it would be logical there. My question would be, if there is, because I'm sure Glasner's planning ahead, he has to be. He's a very intelligent manager. He knows his stuff. He's been here before. If there's an injury, and we do have Chris Richards on our back line who has a pretty extensive injury history, what do you think the next plan would be? Would it be to drop Lerma back or drop Klein in or something else? I mean, those to me are the two that kind of stick out, but I'm not sure what he would go with.
It probably depends, to be honest, on who else is available for the rest of the pitch. If there's two central midfield players available alongside Lerma, then you think Lerma could probably drop back. You saw last season that he liked Klein there, at that right centre back kind of role, but that was a year ago. Is it still the same, Nathaniel Klein, with a lack of minutes this season? We don't know. So yeah, I think it's very much, it will be depending on the circumstance, and hopefully we never have to see it.
Arguably, the most sort of compelling evidence to answer that question comes with what he did last season, when we had so many injuries, and his first choice was to put Lerma into the back line ahead of Klein. That was after Lerma had a, I think, hamstring injury that Klein came in. So maybe Klein's earned the good favour to fill in there. He did very well in that second half of the season, so much that we were talking about the Nathaniel Klein role being imperative to our system. So I wouldn't be
We do
averse.
talk a lot of nonsense, though, so maybe that was more the case.
Maybe, but I thought he was genuinely brilliant.
Yeah, no, he was very good. I agree.
There is some truth to that. I mean, you can call it what you want to call it. We can be cheeky and call it the Nathaniel Klein rule, but there is some truth to having one of those of your wide center backs have kind of fullback tendencies and be able to shuttle out wide to provide cover for that more attacking wing back. So there is some truth to that. And that's what Chalobah did a really great job with, and
Yeah.
why we thought we'd miss him, but so far, so good with Chris Richards, man. I'm really impressed, especially when how he looked when he played in that role in the beginning of the season versus now. It's a world of difference.
I agree with you on Chris, actually. I was quite harsh on him in a piece I wrote, probably second game back from coming into that back line. And I think those criticisms were probably right. I still stand by those. But he's massively improved over the last couple of games. In the defeat against Brentford at home, I thought he was probably the best in the back three. And then at Manchester United, he was absolutely superb. I mean, he was just so controlled on the pitch. Yes, there was a couple of passes that went astray, but you expect that from Chris Richards, that it's not his game. But defensively, he was just extremely solid.
He just knows how to put in a slide tackle, doesn't he? And he's shown that time and time and time again. My only real concerns with him are those ones on the ball. I think he's so suspect. There was even a moment in the Stockport game where he got done by some League One forward, and we nearly conceded a goal from that. Although I think Mark was partly at fault as well. But I do feel confident with him in the back line, so hopefully he can stay fit.
He's just not going to be the long-term solution, right? That they'll need someone other than Chris Richards. in the summer. I mean, I mentioned it on Eagle Eye Football earlier today. Palace are going to have to do a lot of business in the summer. We're looking at potentially three centre backs, two goalkeepers, a midfield player, and a couple of attackers. And that's, maybe Mateta could go as well. So you might be forced to replace him. There'll be quite a few players leaving. You think of like the likes of Schlupp, Ward, Nathaniel Clyne, all unlikely to be offered new contracts. Mark Gay likely to go out the door because it doesn't look like he'll be signing a new deal. So, and both keepers, Matt Turner and Remy Matthews, likely to leave the club as well. So there's going to be a hell of a lot of business for Palace to do in the summer.
This might be a very weird thing to pick out of all the things you just said. I really don't want to see Remy Matthews leave the club. He's been such a sort of lovely little figure in the background. And
It just depends on what he wants to do in his career. I'm sure Palace will be happy to give him a new contract, for him to be third choice. I haven't sourced that, so I don't know. But just going off what you would expect, he's a reliable third choice, if you like. He's appreciated in the dressing room. He gets on really well with the squad, and he's a big character. So yeah, you would assume Palace would try and tie him down. But if he wants got ambition to go and play football, maybe in the EFL, maybe in Scotland, then he's not getting any younger, so he might want to play some football before the end of his career.
very fair, although having a third choice goalkeeper with, extensive Premier League experience being 15 minutes against Liverpool is invaluable in this day and age. But yeah, I mean, I think overall the window was whelming, if we want to use a term closely associated with our very own Bobby Mantie.
I don't think I'll be able to escape this. I could go on to work for a national, and it's still going to be whelming and underwhelming.
So, just for a second to go back to Ben Chilwell. Obviously, he brings quite a different profile to Tyrick Mitchell, who we've had as a sort of permanent starter for 3 years, bordering on four now. What do you make of him sort of as a player and what he could bring to Glasner's system, Bobby?
Yeah, I really like Ben Chilwell. I think he's an exceptional left wing back, caveated with the fact if he stays fit. Now, Chelsea Champions League winner under Thomas Tuchel, integral to that Champions League winner, an unbelievable left wing back. He's I think it's like 23 caps for England along that kind of line, one's goals. He's just a really attacking left wing back, and it's what Palace have kind of lacked. It's an upgrade on Tyrick Mitchell, for me, in my opinion. It's just, I think it is good business as long as he stays fit. It's opportunistic business. Some people have called it desperate. I don't think it's desperate. I think it's opportunistic. Trevor Chalobah was recalled by Chelsea, which meant Palace had a loan spot. They couldn't get Diouf. Obviously, Ben Chilwell wasn't one they was looking at in December to do in January because they had Trevor Chalobah, but Trevor Chalobah left. Chilwell was available. It made sense to guarantee that a left wing back would be at the club for the rest of the season. Now the hope is that he can stay fit. My understanding is that he is fit at the minute, but not match fit. He's been training alongside Carney Chukwuemeka, in exile at Chelsea. Carney Chukwuemeka has now obviously moved on to Borussia Dortmund. And yeah, as I say, I think it's a really good signing. He's a player with a lot of experience and a lot of attacking output, and fingers crossed he can make an impact for the second half of the season.
Yeah, I agree. I don't really understand the negativity behind this move where some people don't like it. There's not a lot of risk. There's not a lot of risk. I mean, yes, he could get injured, but so could anybody. And if he does get injured, we don't have him for 3, 4 years on contract where we have to keep paying him, and just kind of wasting that money. He's the different profile than Mitchell, and that's what I've been calling for, is maybe not necessarily someone better or worse. We can keep that objectivity out of it, but just someone with a different profile, someone that's going to progress the ball through the middle parts of the pitch, someone that's going to be more active in build-ups, get more touches. Maybe he's not as good defensively, but he does offer, and he's not bad in that regard, and he does offer a lot of more better things going forward than Mitchell does. So it's just a great change of pace to be able to deal with that. And yeah, I think he's at the stage of his career where he's probably not getting minutes, even if he's healthy at Chelsea right now. And he wants to show what he's got and prove himself. So I think he's going to be determined. I think he's going to have a lot of chip on his shoulder, so to speak, and finally get Mitchell some rotation. He needs it. I mean, he was absolutely destroyed those last 20 minutes or so at Old Trafford. So.
Yeah, and it's been long needed cover for Tyrick Mitchell. I mean, he's not had any competition or cover there since Patrick van Aanholt left the club. I mean, it's just negligence of the highest order from the club. He's played so many games, by my understanding from the people I talk to, injured because he's had to play there as he's had no cover. So it is important to get him there. I do kind of understand the negativity from the Palace fans because, if you like, it's underwhelming when you're being targeted with a 19-year-old who's meant to be the next big thing, whatever. That's what you've been told anyway. No one's probably ever watched him play football before, but that's what everyone was being told. So I do kind of get that there's been the whole you're paying a loan fee, paying 70 grand a week for him. But at the end of the day, it's not your money. Like, it doesn't really matter. It's not coming out of your pockets. The club's money. He is a good player. And as long as he stays fit, he will have a positive contribution to Oliver Glasner's system for the rest of the season. Glasner wanted a left wing back. Palace give him a left wing back. He green light the move. He really appreciates Ben Chilwell. And it's good business as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I mean, having watched quite a bit of Diouf for Slavia, Ben Chilwell from 2019 to 2022 is undoubtedly a better footballer. He was unreal, and we haven't seen enough of him due to injury over the last couple of years to see if there's been a decline, which with that amount of time out, you might expect that there is. And that's going to be a factor with expectations. We've been pretty harsh historically as a fan base on players coming from big clubs. If you look at Nketiah, if you look at Daichi Kamada, if you look at Dean Henderson at the start, we seem to sort of expect players with that kind of pedigree to immediately be the best player on the team. And I think with Ben Chilwell, who's been, injured and not played a game in the Premier League for 9 months, probably won't come in and do that immediately, although I'd love to see him get started against Doncaster.
Yeah, I think I'd more kind of prefer 45 minutes or maybe even half an hour against Doncaster. Just test him out. Don't overwhelm him. It's been a long time since he played football. Just get him, settled in, bed him into the side. I do think there's a point to be made about the successful loans Palace have had from Chelsea. Like, as much as people can be frustrated they recalled Chalobah, as much as they can be frustrated that, they had bids turned down for the likes of Conor Gallagher and that they're not the easiest club to do business with, the fact is that, Conor Gallagher, Ruben Loftus-Cheek both contributed to Palace still being in the Premier League today. Michy Batshuayi came in and did a good job at times, occasionally offside, but he's a good forward and he did help the club out massively. And even Trevor Chalobah this season, maybe Patrick Bamford and Loic Remy were slightly the frustrating ones, if you like, of the two. But Chelsea have helped Palace out over the years, as Palace have helped Chelsea out developing their players. It's a good relationship between the two clubs, and they've got a very good player from the Blues again this window.
Little fun fact about Michy Batshuayi: he went from all three of the big Istanbul clubs in succession. So I
Yeah.
guess he wanted the entire city to hate him before he left, and he just joined Frankfurt. But
He's an ultimate journeyman, isn't he? That's the kind of thing I get with Michy Batshuayi. And that, if I remember rightly, his first spell at Palace was very good. The second spell, not so much.
I feel like you can't blame him for that second spell, to be entirely honest, because
You always put that down to actually the how the rest of the team were performing, to be fair. I think certainly in that first spell, Batshuayi was a very good servant to the club.
just to finish on Ben Chilwell, I think it is for me that frustration about Chelsea with the whole Chalobah thing and also the Olise saga as well.
But
But
ultimately, what you're dealing with when you deal with Chelsea. Like, I don't. Every football club is run as a business anyway. Like, people shouldn't be under the illusion that football clubs necessarily have a deep-rooted caring for their players or a deep-rooted caring for pissing people off. They don't. They're businesses at the end of the day. They run like business. But Chelsea, I bet Chelsea are even worse than the rest, right? They have a total disregard for the care of the players, as they've shown with Chalobah. He could have gone there and played two games and sit on the bench the rest of the season. They'll be totally fine with that because he ultimately did the job for them for two games. Yes, it probably would have been better for him staying at Palace. But that was a decision they took. And as I say, Palace know what they're dealing with. Then they deal with Chelsea. They choose to deal with Chelsea. That's their prerogative. And I say there's no real point thinking a whole relationship's gonna break between the two clubs because. They recall Trevor Chalobah. There's not. There'll be another loan from Chelsea in another couple of years' time. It's a good relationship between the clubs.
relationship aside, though, is there not something to be said in us sort of running out of ideas a little bit? Or running out of options, I think, is probably the counter argument that I'll.
No, because See, this is one thing I get annoyed with as well. People were saying that when Trevor Chalobah was recalled, reading through Twitter, that Palace shouldn't be relying on loans when they've been in the Premier League for 12 years. But these are the same people who would say, oh, Palace are an attacker short and they've not used any of their loans. You know, the people were complaining about the club 2 seasons ago or last season, whenever it was, not using their loan spots. So you can't have it both ways.
That's fair. I'm one of the believers that I don't think we should be loaning players from bigger clubs to develop. I just think that that's we're beyond that. But if you're looking at it through the lens of are we going to have depth or are we not, then absolutely, I'm going to side with let's get some depth. So I think you have to see the forest through the trees in that regard a little bit.
But if you think a loan player's right, so if you say Ben Chilwell, use him as the example, he is a player who is probably above the quality that Palace can attract on a permanent deal, wages particularly being a problem there. But you can have him to contribute to your squad for the rest of the season because he is out of favour at Chelsea. Now you would rather have that, right, than not.
Absolutely. No, absolutely. I agree
And
with you.
this is where Palace should be clever in utilising their loans. So say they've got to make 8 signings in the summer. You'd quite like to see them make two or three free transfers, someone along the lines of Carl Walker-Peters. I'm not saying that's one they're going to do. I'm not saying that's one I've heard they're going to do. But that kind of profile who can play numerous positions is an efficient operator. Then maybe get another couple of loans from either European clubs or one of the bigger Premier League sides who will generally improve your squad. And then you spend bigger money on your core players. And already you would have a squad that looks stronger than they do this season.
And once up to match fitness, do you want to see Ben Chilwell start over Tyrique Mitchell?
Absolutely. Yeah, I like Tyrique Mitchell. I do. As much as I've criticised him in the past, I'm a Tyrique Mitchell fan. As I mentioned a lot, I think he's a great left back in a back four. I look, he's improved this season. If you look at the cross against Brighton, it was very good. I thought he had a really good first half at Manchester United at the weekend, but I think Palace are kind of just need that offensive threat from the left, and I think Ben Chilwell gives you that over Tyrique Mitchell.
I would agree too. As much as I love Tyrick and defend him as much as I can on here, because I do think he's a good player. If we're talking about the form that got Chilwell to be in the discussion to be England's first choice left back, then yeah, I mean, that's a no-brainer.
I mean, European Championship finalist, Champions League winner, that kind of pedigree speaks for itself. If you've got that player fit and ready to go, you don't sign him at 70 grand a week to sit on the bench.
But even with that signing now, obviously it leaves us in a precarious position in the summer. Would you expect us to go in for a permanent left wing back in the summer once Chilwell departs?
Yeah, I think it'll be one of Glasner's leading priorities in the summer. Whether it's someone who can play left and right wing back, I don't know. So, as I say, mentioned the Carl Walker-Peters kind of profile. I don't think it will be him. I think we'll have bigger clubs after him rather than Palace. I think Tottenham were mentioned in a report I read during the window. So, but yes, and the short answer is I do expect Palace to sign a left wing back in the summer.
Certainly hope so. Let's move on to the Manchester United game. I think we've waited long enough. Pat, what did you make of the way Glasner set up? And would you say it's fair to say that he tactically outclassed Ruben Amorim?
Oh yeah, 100%. And also just some really weird things that Amorim did, like the false nine, Maino leading their attacking line situation was really odd. You could tell it wasn't going to work for after about minute 10, and they just stuck with it. What they tried to do, what United tried to do, is they tried to, since they're in a similar setup in a 3-4-2-1, they tried to go, 1v1 and push back Munoz. So they tried to pin Munoz back. They tried to get the ball really into their attacking left. If you look at any of the, watch the match or look at the charts or the heat maps or anything, Garnacho, Maino, Amad, they're all in that pocket trying to just kind of overwhelm and keep Munoz pinned back because he is such a great attacking threat. And it seemed to work for a little bit because without Eze on that left side, there wasn't a lot of balance. Kamada didn't have his best performance there. It was a little bit isolated on that right side. And at halftime, you saw that switch. You saw, work through the middle channels a little bit. We saw our aggression work out in our favor. We were winning duels. We were getting to the balls first. We were getting those recoveries. We were, picking our moments to press. And I think the inclusion of Eze coming on just kind of alleviated that side a little bit and helped to open up, keep a little more balance, and allow Munoz to try and start to be Munoz. We saw that especially in the second goal.
Yeah, I totally agree that Oliver Glasner outclassed Ruben Amorim. I just think I agree that the Manu thing didn't work, but it did for about 5 minutes and he nearly scored and it could have been a very different game. But yeah, it was just Amorim said in his press conference after the game that Man United controlled it, we had all the possession and we give two silly goals away. But they didn't control the game at all. The only places they controlled possession is where Palace wanted them to control possession. Barring a spell in the first 5 minutes of the first half and the first 10 minutes of the second half, it was ultimately Palace cruised. I sat in the ground comfortable from the press box. I didn't expect Palace to concede at any point. I thought it was really, really easy for Palace. Man United were really poor. And I was disappointed by Man United, I must be honest, because they'd improved in their form over the last four or five games. They'd started getting results. They looked to be, I don't want to say back, but they looked to have improved. And yeah, they just dropped an absolute stinker against Palace. And testament to Palace and Oliver Glasner because they did the number over them completely. I think Pat raises a really good point, and I wrote it in my piece after the game. If ever there was a game that showed the importance of Eberechi Eze, it was that game at Old Trafford. I led my piece with sometimes you don't realise how good someone is until they're gone. And I just think the minute you took him out of that left-hand side, you noticed the lack of chance creation in the Palace team. And the minute he come on, he created a chance and Palace were 1-0 up. I just think he's pivotal. If you look at the numbers this season, even though he's been turning back slightly, a bit lacks a bit of confidence to drive at teams. He still produced 42 chances in 160 minutes, which is 12 more than any other Palace player. And it's the ninth most in the league when he's played considerably less minutes than the people who created more chances than him. So yeah, I think Eze was vitally important when he came on. It was a welcome cameo for Adam Wharton, who did very well when he came on, set up the second goal, winning the ball in midfield and playing that pass out to Ismaïla Sarr and then a magical pass from Sarr to Daniel Munoz, who set up Jean-Philippe Mateta. And my other real takeaway from the game was, and I know I've gone on a bit too long here, but it was that Jean-Philippe Mateta desperately needs to be offered a new contract. Whether he accepts it or not is another matter. But he's transformed under Oliver Glasner. He is Palace's best player. Yeah, he earns considerably less than Eddie Nketiah. He earns considerably less than Daichi Kamada. At the end of the season, he'll only have 2 years left at his deal. So you reach a crossroads of do you give him the demands or do you sell him? Because you can't have him going into the final year of his contract. Palace obviously unilaterally considered that. Triggered that 1 year extension in his deal at the same terms. And as I say, he deserves new terms. He's an invaluable asset for Oliver Glasner's project. He I mentioned on something else earlier, he's that exact Wout Weghorst mold that Glasner had at Wolfsburg with that tall striker who can score goals, hold the ball up. His dribbling has been sensational at times this season, taking players on. I mean, who knew a man of a 6'3" could do that? I certainly can't at that height. And yeah, he's just to coin his phrase, he's fantastic.
I posted this and I'll give you the updated now over the weekend, but Jean-Philippe Mateta, since Glasner took over, has the seventh most goals out of any player in all of Europe's top five leagues. The seventh most goals since Glasner took over. Tied or actually above now with those two goals on the weekend, above the likes of Kylian Mbappe. So yeah, he's playing pretty well.
It was honestly just such a good performance from him. And with the way he started this calendar year with 6 goals already, you wonder if he's about to start on the same sort of run that we saw under Glasner at the end of last season. And if so, things could get very, very exciting as we head towards the end of the Premier League season. But obviously, such a good individual performance from him. Was there anyone else that stood out to you, Pat?
I mean, we could always make this an appreciation pod about Daniel Munoz, couldn't we? I mean, Daniel Munoz, just another sensational game, had that wonderful assist where he was very much being unselfish and laying the ball off to Mateta for that final kind of seeing off the match second goal. Won the most fouls in the match, so was fouled the most and was just, again, sensational in his duels. I think he was like 7 for 10, so 70% of his ground duels were won. Just an incredible two-way wing back. I don't know what we want to call him, but he continues to improve, and he's making Chris Richards' job a lot easier, filling in behind and doing a great job to ease that transition into Richards becoming our regular starter. So I can't say enough about Danny Munoz. I thought he had a fantastic match.
Ismael Assar also had a good impact at Old Trafford on Sunday. Oliver Gaz has managed to turn a winger into a 10, which is brilliant to see. I mean, his pace getting at back lines is nothing short of impressive. And that pass he played in the build-up to the second goal was just superb. I mean, so incisive, straight through the United back line to slice them in half and practically set up a guaranteed goal.
It's not the first time we've seen that from him either, because he tried that pass earlier in the game to Daichi Kamada, who very unfortunately miscontrolled it. But he also assisted JP in a very similar type goal, actually, at Leicester when he rounded the goalkeeper. So he's clearly kind of got this through pass in him. And for Glazen to identify that, or for Dougie Freeman to identify that and work that into his new role as a 10 rather than a winger, it's so impressive from us as a football club. I think it's a real sign of good talent identification and finding a player that is the right fit. Obviously, he doesn't bring that same level of quality as Michael Olyse, and he won't, but he certainly brings a unique profile and has a skill set that's coming out on top in the system we have.
I was just going to say, it shows you why Dougie has chased him for so many years. I think he's come in and made an excellent impact. Obviously, he had to work to get into the starting 11 when he first came in, and that took a while, and it took a while for him to start having an impact too. But, since maybe 8 games into the season, he's just been an invaluable asset for Oliver Glasner.
Yeah, and it goes to show the team building is not in a vacuum, right? I mean, Munoz has had such a better attacking performances lately, and I don't think that's a coincidence that it's started to happen when Sarr has been a little more comfortable getting into the half space and dropping in and not always running behind and not always staying wide like a winger. So him being able to kind of learn some new attributes is freeing up our wing back to do some more impressive things as well. So just a really good example of kind of connecting those dots and becoming more cohesive as an entire unit.
His play in the central area of the pitch has improved so much because he used to pick up the ball in kind of counter-attack situations quite centrally, maybe in the centre circle, and lose the ball quite frequently, maybe have a poor touch. That was not happening against United. He, especially in that second half, did that job very, very fluently, and it's just good coaching. It's excellent coaching from Oliver Glasner.
Any concerns that was maybe voiced on here by any one of us about his technical ability at the start of the season, I think has been massively put to bed. I think he's really either developed that game or that side of his game has been enhanced, is probably the best way to put it. And Oliver Glasner has certainly drawn that out of him. And as you say, it's testament to his coaching.
I'd argue it's odd that he hasn't been played centrally before now, because his 1v1 dribbling is nothing short of atrocious for a winger of his sort of profile. He can't really take a man on unless he's already running at pace. He's not one to pull out trickery to beat a man like we've seen in the past from our sort of Crystal Palace brand wingers. So seeing him centrally is maybe a better utilization of his attributes and assets.
It could be. And if you look at last spring when we were truly flying at our peak, there was so much pinching our front three together centrally and just combining where, we'd ping passes off two of them while the third one made a run in behind and we were able to play that through ball. So seeing Eze and Elise combine with Mateta in there, that's when we were at our best. So seeing Sarr kind of being able to not do it nowhere remotely close as the guy that's going to end up with 10 goals and 10 assists or more for Bayern in his first season, nowhere near that. But we are starting to see a little bit of that similarities in combining and being able to free up our striker in behind.
What was this I saw about Elise the other day? Is he already done 10 goals and 10 assists?
I think he's at like 7 goals and 7 assists, but in the
It's
Bundesliga
unbelievable.
across all competitions, he might be at 10 and 10 already. Yeah.
Yeah, I'll check now. It's certainly unbelievable, his numbers at Bayern Munich this season. Yeah, so he's 6 and 7 in the Bundesliga. He scored 4 in the Champions League and 1 assist in the Champions League and 1 assist in the Pokal. So yeah, he's getting close to 20 already. It's unbelievable. What a player, man.
And you're not going to replace him. So that's why good for Glasner to try and tweak some things and change the system a little bit to accommodate to what he has, because that kid's one of one, right?
It just speaks of his pure quality as a manager, doesn't it? I mean,
Absolutely.
he's got to be the best tactical manager Palace have probably had in their history. And just hopefully they can hit that kind of, I don't want to say next level, I think it's quite cliche, but I'd take things up a gear maybe over the next couple of years.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of talk about the good performances from Saturday, or rather Sunday. I think one player maybe still looked out of place on what was quite a big opportunity for him starting in his natural position, and that was Daichi Kamada, who obviously has gotten a lot of criticism this season, coming in as one of our highest players at the club with the pedigree that he has, and he has suffered some pretty over-the-top criticism as a result of that, which obviously we condemn. But it was another disappointing performance for Kamada, wasn't it, Bobby?
Yeah, I like Daichi. I make no secret that I like him. I think I did an analysis on here before to say that I think he's probably guilty of overtrying at times, and it just makes him even worse. But actually, I didn't think the effort was there at Old Trafford. I think he was very slow and laboured at times. There was no real like instinctive nature about his play. The passing was poor at times, and he just didn't really offer a threat, whilst offering not much defensively either.
So I was fuming at him for his press at times.
He didn't offer a threat. He didn't offer anything defensively. As you mentioned, there was no real pressing intensity there. And it was like Palace were playing with 10 at time. It was just a good job that United were playing with none. Because, you know, yes, you noticed it, and yes, you wanted him to give more, but the game was so easy for Palace that it wasn't earth-shattering. But yeah, nonetheless, he continues to be disappointing, and we really need to see an improvement from him.
He wasn't at his best, for sure. We already talked about how it kind of made the attacking, when we had the ball, the attack was a little bit one-sided, just because that left side was really tough to get anything through. I almost think now it's the same argument, but in a different regard. He's finally seems like he's fitting in and understanding how to be an eight in this system, that double pivot, you want to call it a six or an eight or a four or whatever, but you know, the double pivot midfielder. He's looked pretty decent there in his last few performances, and all of a sudden it's like, okay, well, maybe he's found his groove, and this is the role that's going to fit him best. And then he gets thrown back into playing number 10, where in the beginning of the season we were saying that's probably where he should be, but now I almost wonder if it's another case of just not being familiar in that role, not being comfortable in that role because he hasn't
played. Thought he looked really good in the pivot at West Ham. That's probably the best game he's played for us. I have had problems with him in the pivot. I've not been impressed with it as I've had with him in the 10. My thing about Daichi Kamada is that he should be the most familiar with the system of any player at Crystal Palace, because he's played there for Glasner before. He's won a Europa League there with Glasner before. Whether that would be in the left 10 or the pivot, he kind of played both roles anyway. And I think this sounds like a really mental thing to say, but it's actually like he doesn't suit the way we play at all. I don't know if he doesn't suit the way we play or he doesn't suit England, but it's certainly one of the two, if not a combination of both. At times when you put him in the pivot or the left 10, much like Eddie Nketiah playing in the striker role or the left 10, it looks like a round peg in a square hole. It doesn't really work at all.
I don't even know if you can put it all on the system as well, because he's not doing the basics.
Yeah, that's why I said it. So it's probably a combination of both.
Like, with no pressure on him, his passes are off. His first touch is off. He doesn't look like he can run past the player. He doesn't seem to know how to press. That could be systematic. His finishing also doesn't look very good once he's in games. In training, he's very good. In pre-match drills, he's one of the best finishers at the club. He doesn't have that in a game, and I have no explanation for it. I just don't understand it.
It's got to be either a mindset thing or just the intensity of the game in England that he can't cope with. As you saw in Italy last year, he didn't suit Lazio at all. He's actually had a really tough couple of years. Not really worked for him at all. Palace looks a very similar story, which is quite disappointing because, you know, that he arrived with so much pedigree and promise.
While we're on the subject of system, I'd like to move into the final sort of section of what I wanted to talk about for this podcast, which is Oliver Glasner's system and a potential link, perhaps based off what Pat and I were kind of chatting about off camera, or I guess off the mic over the last week, which is, could it be related to our poor home form versus positive away form, given that a counter-attacking style in the Premier League lends itself to playing away from home, whilst in the Bundesliga you see teams playing a high line more frequently, regardless of where they're playing. Pat, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, like I said, it's continuing on our discussion that we've had over the weekend. And initially, it's logical, right? I mean, I think we're sixth in away form in the season in league and 16th in home form. So it is common to see counter-attacking style teams, direct style teams do a little bit better away from home because the onus isn't on the opponent as much to attack as it is when they're at home. So I ended up breaking this down and I looked at our matches and 12 matches at home versus 12 matches away. And the numbers really don't show that it's a systemic thing, that it's something that is different. What really it shows is that we just extremely are lacking clinician with our home matches. So I'll just run through a couple of things for you. Every of our underlying attacking metrics are essentially the same, basically one for one. There was one big difference in the amount of through balls, and this is where I just want to show you guys, if someone that does data doesn't look at sample size, don't ever listen to them. Because I could tell you that we have 32% more through balls away from home, but we have six more total, which is one half of a through ball more per match. So the sample size on that is just really small. So I can make that sound really cool and doll it up, but in reality, it's negligible. It's zero. What there is difference in is our non-penalty goals minus our non-penalty expected goals. So essentially, this is looking at your clinician. If that number is around zero, you're scoring at a clip that you should be, air quotes, scoring on. If that number is a positive number, then you're scoring more than, again, you quote, should be, and negative would be less. Away from home, we're still not good, but it's negative 1.2 cumulatively over the 12 matches. So we're scoring about a goal less than we should be away from home. At home, that number is negative six, which is a huge number. That is significantly very, 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 very significant, statistically significant, pardon me. A huge difference. We're not scoring in front of the goal. We're not putting away our chances at home for whatever reason. We can go into why, but that's what the tape is telling us for sure.
Bobby, do you have any thoughts or ideas that could explain this discrepancy?
Yeah, no, I asked Glasner the question after the win at Manchester United. I said another win away on the road. Was that eight unbeaten now away from home? Whereas at home, the form hasn't been particularly great, certainly results wise. And I just asked the question that, is there a counter-attacking thing better suited playing counter-attacking football away from home? And he kind of disreputed that or challenged it, if you like. And said that we have plenty of opportunities to counter-attack at home, but for some reason we just don't take them, we don't drive forward, it's something he's working on with the players. Doesn't really buy into the whole away home kind of thing. But clearly there's something there. Now I'm not intelligent enough to come up with the answers. Certainly if the boss is still struggling to sort it out, then it's not one for me to judge.
Yeah, it's funny. You look at the table and you look at goal difference, and goal difference genuinely tells you a lot more about how good a team is than just how many points they've earned. The higher the goal difference is, generally the better the team. And we can take that one deeper and we can look at expected goal difference, which is just expected goals for versus minus expected goals conceded. It's usually a pretty gold standard in terms of how well a team is playing, because it's basically how many chances are you creating versus how many chances are you allowing. And we have a better expected goal difference at home this year than we do away, believe it or not. Slightly better. It's not hugely better, but it is slightly better. So basically, everything that the underlying data is telling us is that there's no difference in the way we're playing, and we should be doing better at home. But for whatever reason, we're just not being clinical in front of goal when we're at Selhurst Park.
All I can hope for is we find a way to turn that around. I'm honestly really excited by the prospect of Ben Chilwell coming in. Hopefully we see that sooner rather than later. With Wharton coming back as well, it makes me have these memories of how Chilwell was playing in his best seasons at Chelsea, which was this sort of cross penalty diagonal pass onto almost the touchline, where Chilwell would then cut back to a striker or cut back to a centre back from either set pieces or from open play, and Wharton has the passing ability to find Chilwell in those positions. So I'm hoping we get to see that from him. But I do think that's all we've got time for. we shouldn't let this podcast run on for too long, but it's fair to say we've been wanting to lap up the victory as much as possible, and hopefully we can keep the momentum going against Doncaster next week. Are we feeling optimistic for that one?
Gotta be.
Yeah, it should, in theory, it should be fairly routine. Probably the famous last words. But Doncaster have got bigger fish to fry at the top of League Two.
And records will show that Oliver Glasner goes strong in the cups, so you'd expect we see something pretty strong. I'm hoping for an Adam Chilwell first 45,
Adam Chilwell.
Ben Chilwell first 45, and an Adam Morton start. But
I actually hope we don't see an Adam Wharton start, if I'm being brutally honest. I think it's too soon. I'd like to see him get half an hour at the end. Obviously, no Franta, as Glasner revealed in his press conference earlier this week. He'll be playing with the under 21s on Monday night. Both have a game at the same time. I think the under 21s are away to Stoke. No Eberechi Eze after they changed his recovery week around to the FA Cup week and he travelled with the squad. So Manchester United. So maybe we'll see Eddie Nketiah on the left, potentially a first start for Remanese. You'd expect cup goalkeeper Matt Turner to start in goal as he did in the third round. But yeah, it should be a fairly strong Palace side.
that's made me wonder, is that Stoke fixture away from home?
Yes.
The pressure has never been higher for Mateus Franta to prove he can do it on a cold, rainy night in Stoke.
What a start.
But yeah, thank you so much for coming on this late in the day.
Thanks for having me. Apologies if it was a slightly disjointed listen to the listeners. From my perspective, I thought it was a little bit shaky tonight.
The magic of editing will have them wondering what on earth you're talking about. Pat, thanks for tuning in from Tampa. I think it's just about time you treat yourself to that drink, because we're laughing it up over here.
I must admit, it's got very dark in Tampa. I'm pretty sure you started this pod in light.
The sun has basically set while I've been on here, so nighttime is whiskey time, a little nightcap, as they say.
My nightcap will be a bottle of water and getting tucked up into bed.
All right. Thank you very much for listening, everyone. Stay tuned for the post-Doncaster episode, and we will see you all next time.